Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Following the schism, what did William Bickerton do to reunite his church? Dr. Daniel Stone answers that question, and I'm really impressed with what William Bickerton did. Check out our conversation. Hey, I also want to remind you, if you'd like to get some inside scoops, please sign up for our newsletter, at gospeltangents.com/newsletter. You can get some inside scoops and find out about some future interviews and things like that. Now back to our conversation. I guess what's interesting to me is the two groups did get back together again.
Yeah, they eventually do get back together.
So tell us that story.
So what ends up happening, for 22 years, all the church is split into a really interesting part of the chapter. There's this good chunk, to make the soap opera even more dramatic, the people of the Latter-day Saint the LDS Church, it goes all the way up to John Taylor. John Taylor hears about the Bickertonites and hears about how they're split, and basically sends missionaries. And down the line, they send missionaries to St. John and to Pennsylvania to convert the Bickertonites. And they're very successful at doing that, I want to mind you. They convert a lot of Bickertonites because they're like, okay,
Even though they're polygamists, because John Taylor was definitely a polygamist.
Yep, you have several of the missionaries going both to Pennsylvania and going to Kansas, convincing Bickertonites who were strongly opposed to polygamy that polygamy was a true revelation. It goes to show you how you could have really staunch people. It goes to show you how bad the split really hurt the Bickertonite movement. They literally saw it in shambles. This Zionic community or this Zionic religious society that they were supposed to be a part of was not what they had signed up for because it was in shambles. And they were like, you know what? This is one of the converts literally says, this is just a sideshow. I'm going to the true church. Or I'm paraphrasing, but they did say this is just a sideshow. I'm going to the true church. And they go to the Mormons. Several Bickertonites from the Kansas area actually moved to Salt Lake City.
Wow.
So it really split. Not only did the church split up, but a lot of people left the Bickertonite movement. According to one newspaper account, it was within the 70 or 80 members just from Pennsylvania left. The Bickertonite movement got pretty big for a small little church, and I don't know if those numbers are conflated because I don't know exact numbers. The documentation is really sparse on that. But it's very possible that there was a lot of converts to even if that detractor, because the person who wrote that article was a detractor of Bickerton, and it was a past convert of Bickerton who eventually joins the LDS Church who's writing this article, so he could be potentially conflating the numbers. But you know what? Those numbers if he's really saying that, that's just in Pennsylvania. We're not even talking about people who converted from Kansas. He's just saying there was about 70 to 80 people who left Pennsylvania to go to the Brighamite Church. So if he's actually quoting such a high number, it's very possible that the number was at least pretty high. So that's what's happening during that 22-year feud. And there's several attempts by Bickerton to reunite the church under his authority. And William Cadman, every single time, says no. William Cadman was almost 20 years younger than Bickerton. Bickerton was getting much older. And the main movement to reunite the Bickertonite church doesn't actually come from the leadership, from Bickerton or Cadman. It actually comes from the members. The members are from both sides. You start to see members from the West joining Cadman. You start to see members that were Cadmanites in the West joining Bickerton. And they're all kind of saying, okay, let's just unite in general. This is silly. And I'm paraphrasing, but that's really the gist. They're saying, this is silly. We basically believe in the same exact things. We're the same church. Let's just come back together. And William Cadman, to his credit, even though he's constantly saying no, no, William Bickerton is in his late 80s. He knows that Bickerton knows that he's going to die soon. His brother had even died, that I believe was younger than him, if I remember correctly. So he sends a friendly face that was a member of Bickerton's schism, but then eventually joins Cadman. His name was Alexander Cherry, and William Cadman sends Alexander Cherry to St. John, Kansas, to talk with William Bickerton in his late 80s to say, okay, here are the terms. And it's a friendlier face than William Cadman, because William Cadman did meet with William Bickerton before that, and they couldn't come to terms. So Alexander Cherry presents William Bickerton with an offer. He says, basically, listen, if you don't be a prophet anymore, don't recognize yourself as a prophet, you're not the leader of the church anymore, but you can still hold a priesthood position as an elder. We'll bring all of your members in our church, and you can become, we can all just join as one. And, you know, because both churches excommunicated each other. They basically said, we'll forget that that even happened. And they basically said, if you forgive us, we'll forgive you. That was the terms. And William Bickerton, in his last stage, had two choices. He could either die right, being, you know, not an adulterer, you know, and you know, holding on to his pride, and the church is split in two. Or he could help the movement, which was already happening, and bring the church together. And he chooses the latter. He says, he steps down, he's no longer considered a prophet, he's considered an elder. And the church comes back together. It's that easy. Nobody's rebaptized. It just comes back. And they basically forget everything. And he literally thinks, the past is forgotten, I'm forgiven. Because I've stepped down and done all this stuff, I'm no longer going to have that stigma as an adulterer. So he's invited to the 1903 conference in the Pennsylvania area. And he's invited from Kansas because now he's the presiding elder of the St. John branch. But he couldn't make it. He's in his late 80s. So he writes this autobiography of himself to kind of say, you know what, I'm going to leave like this last testament. I know I'm going to die pretty soon. So I want to leave this last testament to the church. And I ask that this would be read at the conference. And he even wants to make it a church tract. It's pretty objective. He says a couple things about certain people, but for the most part, he's very loving and very kind. But the problem with it, he writes this autobiography and sends it to the East, but it blows up in conference. They actually debate it. They actually debated it, broke for lunch, and then debated it some more. And the reason, because they were debating whether we accept it, because William Bickerton wrote his life story as if he had never been excommunicated from the church or had never been an adulterer. And even though those were the terms, that everything would be forgotten and forgiven, William Cadman and the people that sided with William Cadman did not want that. They said, no, William Bickerton apostatized, and then he came back into the church after he repented. That was the narrative that they wanted. And they basically came up, but the conference didn't want this to, you know, the church just came back together. They didn't want this to be a political shamble. So they said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to accept the autobiography up to the point where you were accused of adultery, but everything after that we're going to just, you know, disregard. And we're going to quietly tuck away this autobiography and not pass it out to the church. They thought that was a good political solution. Well, William Bickerton hears news of this, and it breaks his heart. And he literally says in one of the newspaper articles on his 90th birthday, he says, to celebrate his 90th birthday, he says, I feel like Job, that the balance of my life, I will wait until my change comes. Basically meaning he knows that, like Job, he's suffered, he feels like, but at the same point, unlike Job, who didn't have to wait till he died to get everything returned to him, you know, twice as much, he basically says, I'm only going to get vindication when I die. So it's like, it's so sad. It's such a sad story. So William Bickerton, with a little bit of bitterness, when he knows, because he's 90 years old, he knows he's not going to, I mean, this is the early 20th century. The fact that he even lived till he was 90, you know, being this pioneer to the West, was remarkable. Mm-hmm. So he basically asks his friend, who was an apostle in the church, Alan Wright. He says, when I die, and William Bickerton was living with Alan Wright at the time when he's convalescing. I believe, it doesn't say when, but William Bickerton has this moment where his house kind of catches fire and he gets really shocked. Well, he goes to Alan Wright's home and convalesces with him, and eventually he dies not too long after that. So it's potentially around this time he tells Alan Wright, and it actually says in the obituary that he asked Alan Wright to read Job chapter 19 at his funeral. That was a request by Bickerton to Alan Wright. I want you to use this as the funeral text for my sermon. Now, when I was reading when I was doing research, I had no idea about this, mind you. I never knew that. And when I read Job 19, I was like, my mouth literally dropped, and I went, holy cow, this is not a happy sermon. Like, who reads Job at a funeral? First of all, this is one of the saddest stories in the Bible. And this is how I start off the book. And this kind of shows the reason why William, again, third largest Latter-day Saint church, why on earth has this historic figure of American religion never been written about? This major historic religious figure. I mean, he's a pretty significant figure. Maybe not as significant as Brigham Young, or even Joseph Smith III, but a pretty darn close second to Joseph Smith III, you know, who has several things written about him. And all these other little groups plenty of people have written about, even the Shakers, who don't even basically exist anymore. Right. There's been a ton of stuff written about him. Why not William Bickerton? Well, this kind of explains the reason. So William Bickerton knows that his autobiography has been tucked away. He now knows that the narrative of the church is going to basically be, I have been an apostate. I was an apostate that eventually repented and came back in, even though he was the organizer and the originator of this movement. But he sees that the Cadman story and narrative is going to continue to carry, and he's very upset about that. So he asks Alan Wright, who he asks to conduct his funeral when he dies, and says, read this Job 19 as my funeral sermon. And this is part of Job 19 and how the book starts off. It says, my kinsfolk have failed, and my familiar friends have forgotten me. Oh, that my words were now written. Oh, that they were printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen in the lead and the rock forever. Job chapter 19, verses 14 to 24. Prior to his death in 1905, the deposed prophet of the Church of Jesus Christ, William Bickerton, left a final message to the world when he asked Apostle Alan Wright to read the 19th chapter of Job at his funeral. There was, of course, bitterness in this request. The one-time church president had been marginalized, his reputation tarnished by men he had mentored, who had assumed the leadership and cast him aside. Bickerton had been one of the major claimants to Joseph Smith's position as president and prophet of the Latter-day Saint Church. He had led the Pennsylvania saints and those of surrounding areas by prophecy and revelation, and he had overseen a hundredfold increase in the membership from the time he assumed responsibility. And yet, there had been a power play, and he had lost. After investing everything, temporally and spiritually, in the church, he saw nearly everything taken away, leaving him with an affinity for Job and the Bible, and the belief that, like Job, eventually someone would set the record straight or at least attempt to tell the whole story. Over a century has passed, and his achievements and trials are still rarely spoken of among the some 23,000 adherents to the church that popularly bears his name. So when I was doing the research of William Bickerton, what got me into it was that I grew up in the church, was really interested in American religious history and American history in general, found out about my church, because growing up I didn't know my church was an American church. You don't really don't know about Joseph Smith, and when you start reading about Joseph Smith and this huge American religious movement of the Mormon movement, I'm like, well, wait a minute, my church belongs to that. Who's the originator? And the church history books barely talk about Bickerton, and I couldn't figure out why. Well, then I start doing all this research, and then I realize he asked for Job 19 to be read at his funeral, and I'm like, holy cow, at his death, he says Job 19, which is such a sad story. That's not even part of it. You got to go read the chapter and go to the end of the book to see the whole thing. He's literally saying, my children have forgotten me. Everyone's forgotten me. I'm like Job. I've suffered terribly, and I want my story told because I know it's not going to be told. This is Job speaking, and he's literally adopting Job's words for his own life. And you see there's direct parallels. When I read that and I realized, holy cow, before he died, he asked through the message of Job that his story would be told because he knew his story would be tucked away. That's exactly what happened. So in a sense, you could say Bickerton had the premonition to know his story was going to be tucked away for a long time. So from the grave, it's like a cri de cor saying, somebody in the future, please tell my story. Now, I'm not saying, oh, look at me, I was the one that did it, because I had no idea. But when I saw that, you know, even though I'm a historian and I try to be objective, and, you know, this book is, one of my major monographs that even is helping me get the PhD, I'm recognizing that moved me. And I realized, holy cow, okay, his story does need to be told, because not only is this a major gap, not only within Mormon history and Mormon studies, but in American religious history in general, but the poor man asked at his death that at least his story would be told, and that's what I did.
So you're a fulfillment of prophecy.
Yeah. Maybe I won't go that far, because that sounds very pretentious, but I at least like to think, well, hopefully Bickerton's happy with me.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Daniel Stone. In our next conversation, we'll find out if he had any challenges getting access to church documents to write this book.
I was able to get access to all these documents, which I think, as far as I know, no one has ever done before, so which was really fun. I wrote the first 5 chapters of the book. I gave it to the church historian in the 12. They never gave me a clear answer as to yes or no. I will say I can kind of understand, because as apostles or as leaderships of the church, you, as leadership of the church, you're none of them are historians, right? I am. the object of all his of all apostles and any person of the Mormon movement is to promote faith, right? And history can sometimes be like that. So there might be some things. The big issue was the Cadman Bickerton feud. They flat out said, I actually was heard from a couple of them saying that's the big issue that they were afraid of.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at gospeltangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.